I'm Kim Carson. I'm so happy you found my podcast, Conversations with Kim. Whether I'm having a conversation with a celebrity, an author, history maker, record breaker, or the average everyday person, we all have a story to tell. And maybe that story just might change another person's life. We can learn so much from each other. Let us discover some of life's most valuable lessons with today's guest on Conversations with Kim. Today, my conversation is with best-selling author and longtime journalist Ben Greenman, the author of the new book, Dig If You Will, The Picture. You know the lyric, Dig If You Will, The Picture of You and I Embraced in a Kiss. It's a book about Prince, of course. We are coming up on the anniversary of his death this Friday, April 21st. And this is a must-read book, especially for diehard Prince fans. It explores his life, his loves, his music, and everything in between. What it's not a gossip book. It's really an investigative book that delves into Prince's work, his thoughts, and meaningful moments in his music. Thanks so much for talking with me today, Ben.
Thank you.
You are a super fan. So what did you discover about Prince that caused you to kind of pause and reflect on, I don't know, something surprising, something even you didn't know?
When I started doing it, I made a real effort to go through all the records. And one of the things that surprised me was how well the later work held up. It's not primarily a gossipy book, so I wasn't looking for gotcha stories. There are some about how he treated people in his band, his sense of humor. But really, for my purposes, it was the late work and how well it held up against the work that everybody knows.
Yeah, and you know, Ben, that's what I got out of it. I didn't want a gossipy book. We've all heard about all of that. You actually have a lot of new information. Now, Prince was a complicated man, wasn't he? I mean, straight black man wearing bikini bottoms, knee-high heeled boots. What's that all about?
I think from pretty early on, as best as I can tell, he played around with all these ideas because they produced the productive tension that produced work. And then at some point, they may have been real crises for him. So if you look at sex, for example, there's male and female behavior, traditional masculinity, traditional femininity. There's also the tension between spirituality and sex. So how he chose to play all those things out, good and evil as well, became an issue. I think that just produced more work. I think they were real questions for him, but he really wanted to explore them. And almost every song has some part in exploring those topics.
Yeah, and you mentioned spirituality. So where did religion fit into Prince's life?
I think it was a huge part of his life and his work. When I was a very young kid, when I bought his earliest records, I was a Jewish suburban kid in Miami, and I was irritated that he kept thanking God. I wanted my pop music to be taboo shattering and to be about sex and about, you know, sticking it to the man. And I didn't really want to hear him being devout. So as I got older and I listened to the work more, I started to see just how important that was to him, obviously. And a record like Love Sexy, which is in the late 80s, is all about that, about how you reconcile lust and love and God and, you know, earthly pleasures and body and spirit. Later in life, he became a devout Jehovah's Witness, and the counter sort of turned again, and he entered a whole other dimension of being a religious artist.
Yeah, I mean, he went like almost the complete opposite. I mean, he was exploring everything he could, and that kind of led me to this question. Why such a large volume of work? And supposedly there are our vaults of the stuff still locked away. I know this Friday, an EP is going to be released with some new stuff, I think from back, is it 2005 to 2008 or something?
Yeah, supposedly 2005, 6, 7. He did a lot of work because I think he was obsessive, and I think he designed a life that put all the tools that you would need to make work close at hand. First of all, he could play every instrument, so he didn't necessarily need other people to make a song. He could produce. He wrote all the songs. He sang all the songs. So whereas another person in another band, if you're in, I don't know, Fleetwood Mac, you might need to put a call out to get your musicians and the vocalists and schedule a date. Now, he obviously did work with a lot of other people, too, but he could do it on his own. And there's an obsessiveness with exploring these ideas. So there's hundreds of songs in the vault. I think what we're going to find, and this week is a great example, is that they're more legally tangled than we know.
Oh, no.
This EP that's coming out this week is already being challenged by his estate. So we'll see if it actually makes it.
Yeah, it's strange because I heard somebody say, well, it's being released, but, you know, we assume that this is okay with the estate or something. I would hate to see that happen to keep us from what he gave us, he's trying to give us, you know?
Well, that's the question, and it's a complicated one. Is he trying to give us those things, or are they money grabs on the part of other people, or are they somewhere in between? And it's always going to be complicated. Obviously, when an artist of his stature dies, we as the public have some right to his work, but maybe not full rights, and maybe someone who's a really responsible curator should get their hands on it. You know, it's going to be years before this is all truly untangled.
Well, I think it's going to go right to the top of the charts. But, you know, on a more somber note, in the book you talk about when he and his wife, is it Métis?
Métis.
What did losing the baby do to them, the relationship, to Prince himself?
I mean, I think, you know, in the one time that I met him and spent time with him, which was for a music awards with the magazine, he was very normal to my eye. And I think there was always an impulse that he was going to set aside some of this more flamboyant, theatrical living and settle down and be a dad. I can only imagine that it was devastating. You know, he wasn't Michael Jackson, who was sort of a space alien oddball. He was a guy who, underneath all of that, wanted to make a good life for himself and the people that he loved. If you listen to the songs prior to that, on Emancipation, about having a baby, they're very nakedly emotional and very intimate, and it's very sad. I mean, the only thing sadder is his actual death.
One of my favorite songs he does is Sometimes It Snows in April. Tell me about that song.
Well, that song is the song that everybody points to as the premonition of his death, because it's a kind of cryptic song, and it takes place in April, and there's a death and possibly a rebirth and sadness. But it's a great, you know, leaving that aside, I don't think he was a prophet 30 years before the fact. It's just a great ballad and dramatically very important in the Under the Cherry Moon movie. And it showed people at the time what they may not have known about the breadth of his talent, that he could write, I guess most people knew, but they may not have known in full, not only funk songs and sex songs,
right,
and experimental songs,
right,
but just beautiful, moving ballads.
Yeah, that's what I saw it as. It was such a change from what I was playing on the radio at the time. It was like, oh, wow, this guy is like a real artist. He's not just like pigeonholed into something. I read where he had some frustration with the fans and the internet. Where did that come from?
Well, I think he hated the internet at some level because he saw it as a kind of vampire, taking away the experience of consuming music the way we used to. Buy a record, buy a CD, buy a cassette, take it home. And it kind of short-circuited intellectual property rights. Everything suddenly was everywhere all the time. It used to be that if you didn't see a Prince show, you're out of luck. You hear from a friend or you fantasize about going, but you couldn't go get the, you could have gotten the tape, but not as easily as when the internet happened. So he went to war with people over posting videos of his music. He went to war with zines over describing bootlegs, and it was sort of a mess. He alienated a lot of the people who loved him the most, and I think maybe was regretful, but he had a very complicated relationship with the internet. He was both an early adopter and really clumsy when it came to figuring out how to distribute his stuff online.
Yeah, I mean, and do it in a safe way, too. Today, my conversation is with best-selling author and longtime journalist Ben Greenman, the author of the new book, Dig, If You Will, The Picture, a book about Prince. You know, being on the air, and I remember all of a sudden we're calling him Prince, he's Prince, and then the next thing you know, when I have to announce him, he's a symbol, the artist formerly known as Prince. We all thought he kind of lost it then. Why did he do that?
It's part of the whole set of decisions around Warner Brothers, and yet it also feeds into this question of identity. So you're Prince from early on. Someone like Keith Richards thought it was a stage name. He didn't believe it was Prince's real name. He thought it was Prince sort of putting on airs, but it was his name. You're Prince for all this time. Warner is suddenly in control of everything you've made, and you don't want to be Prince anymore because you don't want to be owned. So you become this thing. Now, maybe people would have picked a word instead of a squiggle, most people. But it was sort of interesting. You know, it was, again, a thought-out decision. It contained the male and female astrological signs. It has a little trumpet in there and sort of a royal air to it. So he eventually gave it up. I think it was, over time, a bit of an embarrassment. People made a lot of jokes. But it was important. It was important for him to say, look, this body and mind is still going to make work, even if it's not Prince in the way that Warner Brothers wants it to be.
Yeah, it wasn't labeled. Tell me about the making of Purple Rain, the movie, the investment in it, getting it made.
They had come in with a slightly different script, and they knew Prince was a big star and that he was sort of good for that jump to Elvis or Beatles territory and into film. And they came with a slightly different script, and then it evolved into what we know, which is the family melodrama and this story of on-stage competition between Prince's band and the Time. And, you know, it has so much going for it, both legitimate emotional acting, great performances, sort of a pulpy, campy comic turn by Morris Day. And then he never got back there as a movie star. There's a movie like Under the Cherry Moon, which is, I like, it's funny, it's a kind of period piece. There's Graffiti Bridge, which is not very good. There's a great concert movie, but that Elvis moment where he was a chart-topping star and a movie star and an image maker and a fashion plate didn't really come back in force like that.
No, it was so big. It was just so big. I remember at the time thinking the same exact thing. I'm curious, when you heard the news that he had passed, where were you? What were you doing? And how do you, you're like a super fan, how did you mourn Prince? And how do you mourn Prince now?
I was with my wife about to have lunch, and I got a text from my brother, and then I came back out, and I hadn't read it yet, and she told me the news. And it was very, very upsetting. I think people who really followed him suspected maybe something was up from the previous week when he brought his plane down in Chicago and it was supposedly a severe flu. We found out later that it was a save shot for his opioid dependency. The way I mourned him was by writing the book and putting a lot of that emotional reaction to his death into the book.
Yeah, I didn't know how...
Not being...
Go ahead, please.
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say that it wasn't a sort of objective treatment. I didn't want to do a biography where I, you know, stiffened up my collar and said, this is my memory of Prince independent of my feelings.
Right.
I wanted the feelings in there. So I think I built a lot of those into the book.
Yeah, and like, I've always been a Prince fan, but when he died, like, I didn't realize how hard I was going to take it. I remember getting... just feeling purple, you know, just wanting to wear purple. And I like purple anyway, but I got all dressed up in purple and went out for a hike in the woods and listened to his music and cried and looked forward to this vault that we heard about almost as soon as he was dead. You covered Prince for over 30 years. What do you think makes him so completely unique in our culture?
I don't think that there were other artists who could do all the things he did. And even though he died young, he started so early that he had a long career. So he sustained that level of artistic achievement from, you know, even if you kind of throw out the very first record as a false start, it's still from the late 70s until, you know, last year. So that's a massive time span that's sort of unequaled by other pop stars.
Well, you know,
and also his... Oh, go ahead.
No, please.
I was just going to say his thematic preoccupations were singular also. Not that many people dealt with sex, faith, race, in all the ways that he did.
Did he have a relationship with Michael Jackson?
they were competitors on the charts. And I think that when you got Bad was for a time designed as a duet between them. And there are lots of stories of one of them sort of sniping at the fame of the other. And they obviously hit the charts at a lot of the same times over the years.
Best.
But really, Michael Jackson was even one level above, except for Purple Rain. You know, Michael Jackson as a commercial force was in a different class, I think, than almost anybody, even including Prince.
You know, Ben, I just wanted to thank you. I know you have to go. Best-selling author, longtime journalist Ben Greenman, the author of the new book, Dig, If You Will, The Picture, a book about Prince. Where can people reach out to you? You got social media, website, anything like that?
I'm on Twitter at Ben Greenman. If they want to find out more about the book or anything about me, at princepod.com, princepod.com. There's a site we've set up about the book and a podcast that we're starting. So, and the book is available at any bookstore.
And once it airs, I will put it up on a podcast with the link to buy it. Thank you so much for talking to me today, Ben.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Conversations with Kim. Reach out to me, Kim Carson, via social media. On Instagram and YouTube, Kim Carson Now. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, Kim Carson. Listen to more episodes at kimcarson.podomatic.com. Until we meet again, thanks for listening to my podcast, Conversations with Kim.